This variant is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. We have the best vaccine in the world, the best medicines, the best scientists, and we're learning more every single day. And we'll fight this variant with scientific and knowledgeable actions and speed, not chaos and confusion.
President Biden speaking today about the Omicron variant of COVID. We still don't know much about this new variant yet. What we do know is that it was first identified by South Africa's government earlier this month, and that it has about 30 mutations on the spike protein, which allows the virus to cause infections. It has spread to about a dozen or so countries, including Canada, and Dr. Anthony Fauci believes it's probably here in the United States. The U.S. has banned travel from South Africa and seven other African countries, but we don't know how deadly it is or how easily it spreads. Also unknown how effective the vaccines are. Stephen Morrison is director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, there have been variants that have been more successful in spreading, like Delta, and ones that have been less successful in infecting a lot of people. Is this one, do you think, going to be more successful in transmission?
It's moved very rapidly to assert its dominance within South Africa. And we're not sure if it's driving this current surge or whether it's simply surfing that surge, that the surge was already underway and now it's riding on top of that. The fact that there are 32 mutations on the spike protein is kind of, from a scientific standpoint, I'm not a scientist, but just reading all of the commentary coming across social media from scientists over the weekend, there's a certain implicit fascination and alarm at the scale of mutation and the complexity of all of this. You know, as you point out, we don't know if this variant makes you sicker and has a higher pathogenic potential in creating extreme illness and death. We don't know that. We don't know if it's able to evade the protections that we have, i.e., if we're fully vaccinated, if that protection is going to decline significantly.
When can we expect to know that? Know if the vaccines are effective against this?
2 to 3 weeks.
2 to 3 weeks.
The scientists are saying that's the time required in order to do the kind of trial testing in sufficient numbers. Believe me, there's extraordinary activity underway in Southern Africa, particularly in South Africa, which has exceptional capacities for scientific work, for lab work, genomic sequencing and the like. We're very fortunate that both.
Do we know? Yeah, we are fortunate that they were able to identify this and alert the world. Do we know for sure that it originated in the southern part of Africa?
No one knows that for now. I mean, you can argue that the countries with the best surveillance capacities are going to be the first to discover cases in their midst. And that's true for Botswana and South Africa. So does that mean, I mean, there's very, very, very limited genomic testing. One thing about this virus that's interesting and very valuable is that you can detect it using a PCR test. You don't necessarily need to use genomic sequencing. And so labs that are running PCR tests are able to differentiate between what might be a Delta version versus an Omicron variant.
Is that happening here in the United States? Are the labs testing for this new variant?
We're running here in the U.S. something around 90,000 genomic sequences a day. That's still less than 1%, but it's more than a doubling of what we've been doing up to this point. And we're also, the administration, President Biden's team, have been working very assiduously with Moderna, BioNTech, Pfizer, and J&J for them to accelerate their efforts at potentially retooling their vaccines.
Well, we don't know for sure where this first emerged and how this virus first mutated, but we do know that there are more cases in the southern part of Africa, including South Africa, than elsewhere in the world right now.
Can I just say something about that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, take South Africa. South Africa is the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. There are over 7.5 million people living with HIV. In South Africa, it's also the epicenter of the tuberculosis pandemic. So you have a large population of people who are immune compromised. Mm-hmm. Immune compromised people, one theory around how variants are generated is that the virus enters a person who's immune compromised, and that person never regains health status to expel the virus. And so the virus lives on and mutates continually within immune compromised people. Well, you have an enormous pool of immune compromised people in South Africa and across Southern Africa. And so we shouldn't be surprised that when you have that factor, and then you have only 25% of your population fully vaccinated in South Africa, very high vaccine refusals and vaccine hesitancy, you can have uncontrolled transmission, uncontrolled replication, and a population, enormous population, that has a compromised immune systems.
And do you think the West made a mistake by not flooding the zone with vaccines early on or earlier?
Absolutely. No, I mean, we the sort of nationalist hoarding by the most powerful and wealthiest countries of the world, most of the vaccine production is concentrated in four places, right? Europe, United States, India, and China. All four engaged in systematic hoarding. And so, yes, we made a terrible error in not having an approach that could walk and chew gum at the same time. In other words, an approach that took care of our own requirements here at home, but also fully appreciated the need to flood the zone, as you put it, in low-income countries where uncontrolled transmission is only going to throw forward new variants.
Stephen Morrison is director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Coming up, the Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to talk about the Ghislaine Maxwell and Jesse Smollett trials. That is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Two high-profile criminal trials are underway today. Ghislaine Maxwell, the longtime associate of Jeffrey Epstein, who killed himself in a Manhattan jail cell 2 years ago. He'd been accused of running a prolific sex trafficking ring of underage girls. Maxwell also accused of sex trafficking, and she faces up to 70 years in prison. And in Chicago, actor Jesse Smollett faces charges he fabricated a hate crime against himself. That was nearly 3 years ago. It's Monday, and we're going to talk about these cases with Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So remind us about who exactly Ghislaine Maxwell is in relation to Jeffrey Epstein, and what is she charged with specifically?
Yeah, so she's a British former socialite. She's the longtime companion and alleged girlfriend of Jeffrey Epstein. And in general, as you said, she's accused of sex trafficking and related charges, essentially helping Epstein to have this criminal sex enterprise. Now, the specific charges here, there's basically three charges: enticing a minor to travel to engage in illegal sex acts, transporting a minor with the intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, sex trafficking of minors, and then conspiracy for all three of those charges. So that's what she's looking at in her trial that's starting today.
And when you're talking about a minor, is she just accused of one, of doing this to one person or many?
No, there's a number of alleged victims here. So just reading the statutory language where it talks about a minor, but no, you're exactly right that there's more than one alleged victim here.
Okay. And the prosecution's main argument is that she was basically doing this alongside Jeffrey Epstein.
Right, that she was assisting him in every way, that she found these underage girls, that she groomed them, that she, in fact, said to them, I'm going to pay you a lot of money if you give Epstein, for instance, a massage, that she knew full well that he was then going to sexually assault these girls, and that in certain cases, she actually more directly took part in the sexual assault, but that the general idea is that she was, for lack of a better way of describing it, his right-hand woman in allowing him to perpetrate all of these alleged crimes.
Yeah, I think the federal prosecutor today called her a predator and that they were partners in crime. Do we know who is going to testify? Will some of these alleged victims testify on the stand?
So some of them will. It looks like there'll be four of the accusers who will testify. We won't know their names because the judge has said that we can keep that private. But that's not all we know, but that's about what we know with respect to the witnesses. We don't know who else is going to be called, what else they're going to say. And again, right now, we just know those four accusers will take the stand. Some of them have actually spoken to the media thus far. What they've said is very emotionally impactful. So obviously, one of the big questions will be, how does the jury react to that testimony?
Right. And Virginia Giuffre, who is the highest profile accuser, she's not going to be testifying at trial. Why is that?
So it looks like she's not going to be testifying at trial. We think because there are some alleged inconsistencies or problems with her story. And I think in this case, the prosecutor wants to stick to these four key accusers who I think have more consistent stories that line up with the strategy and the tact that they're taking here of trying to prove that Ghislaine Maxwell engaged in these three different counts and the conspiracy charges.
And do we know what she is going to argue or her lawyers?
So we know that what she's argued both in and outside of the courtroom a bit. She's argued that she can't get a fair trial, that in fact, they're just trying her because Epstein is not available, that this is kind of trying Epstein by proxy. I think there might be some arguments that she also was one of the victims. And then it looks like based on testimony that they're going to solicit from a psychologist, that in general, she's going to try and undermine the credibility of the accusers, that she's going to come forward with a psychologist who talks about false memories, who I understand testified in the Harvey Weinstein trials. And basically, I think, try and say, look, this happened a really long time ago. We're talking about acts that occurred from 1994 to 2004. And are you sure that you really remember it this way? And that is, frankly, one of, I think, the bigger problems for prosecutors when it comes to these older cases is that memories fade, and particularly when we're talking about decades old allegations here.
Okay. Meanwhile, not so long ago, nearly 3 years ago, Jussie Smollett, the Empire star, claimed he was assaulted in Chicago while his attackers yelled racist and homophobic and pro-Trump slogans. And then he says they beat him and tied a noose around his neck. And then prosecutors say he staged the entire thing. So what is he being charged with?
So he's being charged with six counts here a second time. There were some charges that were initially dropped, but basically of lying to law enforcement. The idea that he fabricated this whole story, that he paid two brothers to create this fake attack, that he in fact inflicted these injuries on himself. And that's the crux of the charges, that he made false statements to law enforcement.
And these two brothers, are they going to be testifying for the prosecution?
So we don't know. We can suspect that, yes, they will. They have not been charged. So I think part of their decision to not be charged is that they will, in fact, be available for the prosecution. And they have said, we were paid to stage this attack. And that's, of course, very damning for Jussie Smollett.
And what is he arguing?
So he's arguing that there's other reasons that you can kind of explain away the payments, that he was helping to pay for their fitness and training. He has maintained the entire time that no, this was not fabricated. He was in fact attacked. He said that there are, that he can prove that there are people, not these two brothers, who engaged in the attack, and that he can again provide alternative explanations for those payments to the brothers who he previously knew.
Right. So he allegedly paid them $3,500. How do you expect this case to play out?
So this is a long and winding road case in terms of how it actually came to the jury at all, or it came to trial at all. These charges were actually brought. There's a special prosecutor who looked into the DA's office decision to charge and then say, no, we're not charging you. How do I expect it to play out? I think it really will be, a lot of this will hang on whether or not the jury can try and, or can believe that there is some alternative explanation here.
All right, Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal here on Press Play. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, playwright Sarah Rule on losing her ability to smile after contracting Bell's palsy, which didn't go away for years.
I decided to live inside my mind instead of my body. I wrote off my body as a source of disappointment.
Sarah Rule is here to talk about her new memoir. It's called Smile, and that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. When Sarah Rule's play opened on Broadway, she had every reason to smile. It was a high point in her career, and she had a full and satisfying personal life with three young children and a loving husband at home. And yet she literally could not smile. She was suffering from Bell's palsy. That's a mysterious and sudden paralysis of the face that is usually temporary and usually resolves on its own. Not for Sarah, though. She writes about losing this essential human trait, the smile, in her new memoir. It's called Smile, The Story of a Face, and Sarah Rule joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's go back to when you first got Bell's palsy. You had just given birth to your twins. You had had a difficult pregnancy, a difficult birth, but the twins were born healthy. You named them Hope and William. Mm-hmm. And the next day, the lactation consultant comes in to check on you, and she notices your eye is droopy. What did she say to you, and what was your reaction?
So I was lying in bed, and I think she was teaching me the football hold. You know, you're trying to learn how to breastfeed two babies at once, and there are these various holds. And she said, your eye looks a little droopy. And I said something like, yeah, I'm Irish, thinking about my great uncles who, when they had too many gin and tonics, you know, their eyes became little crescent moons. And she said, that's not what I mean. Go look in the mirror. Indeed, the whole left side of my face had sort of fallen down and was immovable. And at first, I thought I'd had a stroke. And a neurologist came in and diagnosed Bell's palsy.
And did you know what Bell's palsy was?
Funnily enough, I did, because my mother had it in her 50s, and her bout was much quicker than my bout.
Were you alarmed? Because Bell's palsy, as you say, it resolved quickly with your mother. It normally does. Most people, it clears up after a few months.
I was alarmed in that it's just an alarming feeling not to be able to smile. I couldn't say my P's. I drooled when I ate, and I had, you know, terrible headache, and loud noises hurt my ear. So my baby's crying was painful because the cranial nerve sort of muffles sound. The particular neurologist I had, I found alarming because he sort of said, well, we don't know if you'll get better or not. You probably will. So I think there was something about having an idiopathic disease where you don't know what the outcome will be that was alarming.
Mm-hmm. Or it's not really well known how it's caused in the first place, right?
Right. I mean, they know that it can be caused by a virus. They know that women in their third trimester postpartum can have it. They know that Lyme disease can cause it, but they don't truly know what causes it and what cures it.
You mentioned that you joked about being Irish, but is there a connection to Bell's palsy and being Irish?
And the Irish? No, none at all. I mean, they say that Bell's palsy can be genetic. My uncle's had it. My mom has had it. Turns out I do have celiac disease, which was probably an underlying reason why the Bell's wasn't going away quickly. And that was caused by some, you know, random story I was telling my neurologist where I told him what I said to the lactation consultant, which made me sort of meditate on medical narratives and how sometimes it's the smallest little clue you give to a doctor that leads them to make a diagnosis.
Why? Because celiac disease is more common in people of Irish descent?
It is. It is.
Huh. I
don't know why, but my neurologist, when I told him I wasn't getting better and I said my little thing of, oh, well, I'm Irish, he said, I'm going to test you for celiac disease. And it turned out I had it. And what was interesting about that is celiac means you're not digesting your food properly. So I wasn't getting B12 vitamins, and B12 vitamins are what cause the nerve to regrow. So my nerve effectively was being starved, or my nervous system was being starved.
Wow. So a lot was going on with you physically. And you also had these two babies, well, three young children. You had a toddler mm-hmm. and twins. And you have this play opening on Broadway. How did you keep it all together?
Well, I think my Midwestern pluckiness and stoicism and sheer force of will kept it together for quite some time. You know, I adored my babies, and I adored my my older daughter and my husband, and I love writing plays. And so I immersed myself in daily life and kind of shoved the fact that I wasn't getting better way down. I think at a point I didn't keep it together. You know, there was mm-hmm. a point where it did all become too much. You know, that began a path towards eventually getting better. But I think I hesitated to write the narrative for a long time because in a way the story is a woman slowly gets better. And I thought, what kind of story is that? You know, what kind of story for a playwright who believes in catharsis and apotheosis? But I think for me, both spiritually and physically, the path forward was strewn with disappointments and uncertainty, but slow incremental getting betterness.
It took you a long time because, unlike most people, it didn't clear up on its own. And you tried all sorts of different approaches, acupuncture, chiropractor, Zen Buddhism, all sorts of stuff you tried.
It took about 10 years for me, and I'm not totally better. I probably never will be totally, quote unquote, cured. My smile is crooked, and when I speak, it's a little bit lopsided. But just to be able to smile, to communicate that I'm smiling, to blink, to communicate friendliness to strangers, to laugh in public. I mean, all these things that I couldn't do for a very long time, now I can do, which is, you know, incredible.
So until that time when you started to get better, for many years, you weren't getting much better. And did you say, okay, well, this is just how I'm going to be for the rest of my life? Half of my face is going to be partially paralyzed?
I felt like I was in a deep freeze. I talk about in the book, The Winter's Tale, where Hermione gets turned into a statue and, you know, eventually melts. But I felt like my face was in a deep freeze. And so I decided to live inside my mind instead of my body. I wrote off my body as a source of disappointment. And I thought, well, I'll write plays, I'll think, I'll love my family, I'll do all the activities I normally do. And I kind of gave up on my body.
But there is a connection, as you discuss in the book, between your body and your mind, and the fact that you, when you physically can't smile, you don't feel joy. Like that it's hard for humans to feel joy if they can't smile. Like it's linked.
It absolutely is. And I remember reading a meditation book, you know, trying to get some calm, and it said, smile when you meditate, you know, it creates the sensation of joy. And I just wanted to fling the book across the room because I couldn't smile. So I couldn't kind of create joy on the inside by manufacturing it on the outside. And I think this divide grew where my mind and body were not linked up. And so I started to really retreat inwards because I couldn't make certain expressions on my face. I just didn't try. I just tried to remain neutral and impassive. And I think for a writer, that was maybe an easier stance than for, say, an actor to retreat into an observer role. And I think, funnily enough, it was not until I started writing the book that I started to put the two halves together again.
When you're talking about being neutral and impassive as a writer, maybe that is good professionally, but at home, you can't do that. I mean, you have little kids, you have to be involved. And especially when it comes to modeling human emotions, there's this concept of mirroring between adults and infants, where they look at you and mirror your expressions. So how did you do that with your young babies and even your toddler? How were you able to communicate happiness and joy?
Well, honestly, it killed me that I couldn't smile at the babies in particular. I felt like Anna was grown up enough that she could read my intention. But these babies, I thought, were, you know, in a way, tabula rasa. And here I was trying to teach them love, trying to teach them joy, trying to show them how much I love them on my face. And I was worried that all that was registering was a lopsided kind of grimace. Because in the acute stages of Bell's palsy, when you try to smile, it doesn't necessarily, at least for me, in my self-image, look like a half smile. You know, it looks distorted, or it can. So there are these neurological studies they do with depressed mothers where they show what's called still face to the baby. So first you play with the baby and you're happy with the baby, and then you suddenly show no emotion. You show them still face and the babies freak out. And I thought, oh my God, am I showing my baby still face? And I think what I realized long after the fact, even when I was writing this book, I looked back for pictures of myself and I could find very few pictures because I didn't want to be photographed at the time. But I found a lot of videos I was taking of the babies where I was taking the video because I always wanted to be behind the camera. And I found that I was smiling with my voice at William and Hope. You know, I was constantly with the warmth of my voice showing and giving love. And it's funny that I didn't realize at the time that touch and gesture and the voice is as capable of showing warmth and affection as the face is.
I think we're all learning that now that we all have to wear masks when we're trying to talk to people and express warmth. We have to use our eyes
absolutely
more and be more expressive with our eyes and our gestures.
Yeah, I think we're using our eyes more, we're using our hands more, we're making weird little murmuring noises, listening noises, and we're having to be direct. We're having to say the things that we might have tried to just encode with our facial expressions. But I do think, you know, as with the Bell's palsy, there's also a loss. There's all the compensating that you can do, which is so resilient and wonderful that other senses take over. But I do find that there is a loss with the mask, that it's harder to invite human connection without the whole face.
So when we all started putting masks on, did you feel like, oh, I got this. I kind of know what to do here. I understand how to communicate.
I was like, great. Yeah, it wasn't much of a transition for me because I had felt so masked for a decade. It didn't feel like a shock to me.
So I guess I was a little curious to know why you write in the book that you didn't really Google your condition for a couple of years after you were diagnosed. And you even had a neurologist friend whom you didn't contact for many years until after you had been suffering from this. And instead went to like one neurologist who was awful, another one whom you mentioned who was good, but a series of good and bad doctors and different experiments with therapies. But I guess, did you not want to know exactly what this condition was? It seems pretty straightforward if you just Google Bell's palsy, like what you should do for it.
I had certainly Googled Bell's palsy. I think I hadn't wanted to know that I wouldn't get better. And I think there was the shame of the quote unquote bad patient. You know, when I first went and saw my neurologist after 6 months and wasn't better, he was kind of like, show me what you got. And I tried to smile and he's like, you're not better. You're not going to get better. You need experimental neurosurgery. There was a sense that there was something wrong with me for not getting better or for being an outlier in the pattern of the disease. So I knew the basics. I knew that the first line of treatment is steroids, which I did have. I didn't know that you should have had antivirals, which I didn't have. But I think I trusted my doctors. I listened to my doctors. And I think it took me a really long time to be more active mm-hmm. in the process of trying to get better and to try to find the right specialist.
You figure out that going to a physical therapist is the best thing for your recovery. And you make some really incredible gains and really contradicted what that neurologist at the beginning told you, that mm-hmm. if you didn't do better in 6 months, well, you could just give up. Mm-hmm. That you were able to retrain your facial muscles through patient hard work. It's mm-hmm. it's really a story of hope.
Yes, and I think that the idea of function and strength and what can your muscles do, I mean, that was the revelation to me. I mean, I think I had felt totally objectified in the medical process before then. You know, it was usually a man looking at me saying, how much of a smile can you give me? And that was literally the language they would use. And then I went to a physical therapist who was a woman who herself had had Bell's palsy, and instead of saying, show me what you've got, she would do expressions with me instead of making me look in the mirror with a forced smile that I couldn't even replicate. She would have me look at her face and she'd say, smile, and we would both smile. Or she would say, grimace, and we both grimace. And there's this concept of learned non-use with stroke victims, where if you don't use a muscle for a long time, it forgets how to move. With physical therapy, I was able to wake some of that up. It's mysterious. In my case, who knows how other factors like celiac disease played into the fact that my recovery took an endless amount of time. But I really think physical therapy helped me a great deal.
Right. And at the outset, you said you had just decided you would live in your mind and not your body, but it was this decision to live in your body that helped you recover.
It was. And the ironic thing is I think I decided to live in my body by writing a book about my body. This is the masochism of the writer. You know, it takes writing a book to decide to live in your body.
So how many years has it been now? More than
10. It's been 11 years. My twins are 11 now.
Oh, wow. And what does your smile look like?
My smile looks crooked, but it looks like a smile. You know, I think the really hard part when I had acute Bell's palsy was feeling like the smile didn't register as a smile. So, for example, my mother would misread the expression of my face if she was on my left side. But now I think people know what I'm trying to communicate. My face can register joy. And so to me, that is quite hopeful.
Do you remember the first time you smiled without thinking about it?
Like trying to force it? I remember walking in the East Village and then a grandfather walking down the street with his granddaughter. And she had a ball, and she threw the ball at me, and I sort of picked it up and threw it back to her, and I smiled at the grandfather without thinking.
And he didn't react badly. It was a normal
smile.
No. And he smiled back.
He smiled back, yeah.
It's always nice to get a smile back.
It's so nice to get a smile back. I mean, it is one of the great unappreciated things in life, and I think we appreciate it even more now that we've been masked for so long.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed your book a lot. This isn't part of the Bell's palsy narrative, but I found that in your acknowledgments, I was really moved by this haiku that you wrote about your husband.
Thank you so much.
He had just fixed the Scotch tape dispenser, and you write, the tape was unseen, trapped in itself. You found the beginning again. Mm. And I thought that was so beautiful and also just a great way of describing what you've been through, too.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. I was writing a haiku a day during the pandemic just to keep sane, and sometimes these mundane things, I brought my husband the Scotch tape, and I hate it when you suddenly lose the scotch tape and that invisible, mm-hmm. you know, and you keep trying to pick at it with your fingers. And I think I brought it to Tony, my husband, who's very, you know, patient and good at fixing things. And he immediately fixed the scotch tape and found the beginning of the tape again. So the haiku is quite literal in a way, describing what happened with the scotch tape. But I think also my husband's patience, both of our patience in a marriage over time, helping each other find the beginning again. And I think when you have a partner who has a chronic illness, and so many people have been through this, the patience, the caring, the seeing the beloved over time and letting them see themselves through the seeing of them, it's so moving to me, you know, the duration of that.
Well, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. Sarah Rule is a playwright whose works include In the Next Room or The Vibrator Play, and that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Best Drama. She also wrote the libretto for the opera Eurydice, which is now at the Met in New York through December 16th. And her new book is called Smile, The Story of a Face. Coming up, we talk to Maria Zardoya of the LA band The Marias. They have a new album and a brand new Grammy nomination. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Today on the show, a little psychedelic soul.
I wanna make you feel
That's Little by Little by the band The Marias from their debut album, Cinema. They use jazz, indie pop, some reggaeton to create a dreamy soundscape with lyrics in both English and Spanish. The Marias were formed here in LA by Maria Zardoya and Josh Conway. The new album was produced and recorded inside their home in Beechwood Canyon during the pandemic. Now it's been nominated for a Grammy for Best Engineered Album. And joining us to talk about their sound and story and the new album is the band's lead singer, Maria herself. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the Marias, there's just the one, you, right?
Yes, I'm the only Maria in the Marias.
Well, the other key figure is your romantic partner, Josh Conway, correct? Who's also your partner in the band.
Yes.
And how did you two meet?
We met here in LA at a little venue called the Kibitz Room. It's next to the iconic Cantor's Deli. Mm-hmm. And I was playing a very, very small show there with my friend, and Josh was running sound. And he came up to me after our set and he was like, you know, I really like your voice and I like your songs and I have this studio. Do you want to come record? And I thought it was just really cute. And I was very attracted to him. And so I took him up on the offer and we just kind of got to know each other. And it wasn't until, you know, a year into our relationship that we started writing songs for film and TV that later made it onto the Maria's first two EPs.
Well, speaking of films, you have a song at the end of the album called Talk to Her, which is the title of a Pedro Almodovar movie. And is this an homage to that movie?
Absolutely. I've just always been inspired by Almodovar. He's my favorite director, and I grew up watching his movies. My dad is from Spain and kind of grew up in the same times as Almodovar in Spain, and where they sort of had this huge creative revolution after Franco. So I'm just a huge fan of his, and our aesthetics and music have always been inspired by his movies.
Well, let's play a little bit of that. This is from your album, Cinema. The track is called Talk to Her.
It all comes and goes in waves. Everything looks the same. The cornfields, the cows, the flies, the coughing, the musky air that fills our rose permeates even through the ash-infested fence. Fires, eating away at the barks of trees like this moment, eating away at the last dose of happiness lingering on the dust of our bones.
Wow. That sounds pretty dark. Eating away at the last dose of happiness, lingering on the dust of our bones. What are you writing about?
This was during a very difficult time for all of us collectively in the band. We were on a support tour, and it was just a really just dark and difficult time. And I got out my little journal and I wrote the poem and talked to her. Or I guess, you know, I see it more as sort of like a stream of consciousness journal entry. And yeah, it's pretty melodramatic, but I think it represents, you know, the time where we were.
So you weren't enjoying being on tour as the opening act?
No, not that particular tour. It was, you know, we were opening up for a legendary band, you know, and they sort of had their routing based on a bus. So they were going around these cities on a bus, and we had our van. And so we would, you know, be driving all these distances during the day. It was just very late nights, very, very early mornings. And since they were such a legendary band, everybody was there to support them as they should. And nobody knew who we were. And, you know, so the lights would be on while we were playing and like people on their phones. And, you know, we did our best. We did our very best, but it was really difficult.
Can you tell us who the band was?
Yeah, it was Café Tacuba. Like I said, I mean, they're like legends. Okay. So, you know, when you buy a ticket to see Café Tacuba, like that's the only person you want to see. That's the only group you want to see.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be really disappointing to be opening up for this band and like nobody's listening to you or nobody's really there. Or very few people are there to see you.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there was a bit of a disconnect, but we really tried and, you know, tried to make the most of it. And at least this, you know, this song came out of it.
Well, you have some of your songs, as we played in the intro, in Spanish and some in English. And talk a little bit about your background. You grew up, as I understand it, in Georgia, but were born in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I was born in Puerto Rico. I moved to the States when I was really young, but we would always go back to Puerto Rico for Christmases and summers. You know, growing up, I, you know, was listening to music from, you know, all of Latin America, really. But every time I would go to Puerto Rico, my cousins and I would go to like the record store and just pick up a lot of CDs and just sort of talk to the people who worked there. And they would always, you know, give us recommendations for, you know, new artists that were out on the scene, new local artists. So I grew up listening to a lot of Latin music and of course, reggaeton, Daddy Yankee, Zion y Lennox, Wisin y Yandel. Yeah, so I love that music as well.
So let's play another song. This one sung in Spanish. It's called Fog as a Bullet. So for our listeners who don't understand Spanish, what are you singing there?
So this song is about losing someone, not in a sense of heartbreak, but in a sense of they're just not here in this, on this planet anymore, or in this dimension anymore. I wrote it the day after Kobe Bryant passed away, and it was just heartbreaking that somebody, you know, just that we think is just invincible, just suddenly isn't here anymore. I mean, it was so tragic as well. And so I think it was just that the feeling of like losing this person that felt so permanent to us.
Mm. Yeah. And he and his daughter and the others on board mm-hmm. that helicopter, they died in foggy conditions. It was, and so hence the title, Fog as a Bullet.
You know, just a couple of days before the accident, I was looking out my window and admiring the fog. And I was like, wow, this is so beautiful. It just gives everything just a soft and cinematic sort of light. And just 2 days later, it was the same fog that caused this, the tragedy. So, you know, it was just that the realization of how can something like that I thought was so beautiful, like cause so much destruction as well.
Hmm. Yeah. Something so soft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you think of wind or lightning as hard or, you know, driving mm-hmm. rain, but fog. Speaking of soft, your singing voice is very soft and delicate. How did you learn how to sing?
I don't know. I think I just, you know, my dad taught me a few chords on guitar. And after that, I just started, you know, singing and writing my own songs. And I can't say that it was something that I learned. It was just something that I enjoyed doing, and it works for the music that we're making. So
what is it like working and living with and being in a romantic relationship with the same person?
It's really difficult. It's really rewarding at times, or a lot of the time, I think it's really rewarding, but it's also really difficult because, you know, everything is so intertwined and everything that we do is together. The idea of separateness in a relationship is really important, and having your own individual lives. And that's something that we found to be pretty difficult in our relationship because there's not a huge level of separateness in what we do.
So how do you draw those lines? Because we have all been trying to figure that out during this pandemic, and I guess
yeah,
you've had a head start.
I mean, we're figuring it out. Currently, we're not living in the same place. I think we realized, okay, like this is too much together. We need some level of individuality and separateness. So it's just extremely important in a relationship to have, you know, something that's more mysterious, because once you spend every waking moment together and are business partners and creative partners, there's not much mystery, mm-hmm. you know? So having that level of, okay, you're living there, I'm living here. Like, you know, we'll see each other and we'll have more to, you know, more to say, more to talk about. There will be that level of mystery that is very much needed. And we're just trying to figure out how to navigate this project and relationship and everything that entails, the ups, the downs, and everything in between. So,
well, let's play another song from the album. And this is, I guess, can illustrate what we're talking about. This one's called All I Really Want Is You.
All I really want is you. What would you do?
Just beautiful, and it really feels like a really intimate moment, an intimate time that you're talking about there.
Yeah, it was the middle of last year, and you know, where the entire country, the entire world was in quarantine, and you know, we decided, okay, if we can't sort of go anywhere, really, and so we were like, you know what, let's go on a mental trip. And so we took a little bit of acid and we walked around the neighborhood for like 8 hours, and it was just the perfect like mental vacation. And that's kind of how this song came about.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it to go there, but well, that's one way to handle the lockdown.
Yeah, sure. It was a beautiful experience and helped us feel in touch with, you know, with obviously with nature and with the world, and really made us feel like, okay, we're in this together and we're experiencing, you know, this as a collective whole.
So now that people are going out now to shows and all that, will you go on tour to promote this album?
Yes. Thankfully, our first tour since the pandemic will be next January, at the end of January. And we'll pretty much be touring until July. So most of next year we'll be playing shows, which I'm really excited about.
And you'll be not the opening act, but the act. this time.
Yes. we will be an opening act, but you know, now that we have that experience and know kind of what to expect and what to do, I think it'll be better. Everything is a learning experience, and I'm glad that we went on that tour, because like I said, I mean, we learned a lot, and it helped us grow as a band.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you, and congratulations on the new album and the Grammy nomination.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Maria Zardoya of The Marías, the band's debut album is called Cinema. It's out now. So I'ma lay here, make a drink and have a holiday here. Diamonds on the bed to hold your place here. I won't be out of your life too soon. I'ma live in the past, look at the videos. I'ma give you the real, what do you wanna know? But I'm calling you back, don't wanna be alone. Cause you do me like that, why would you do me like that? Cause mama told me keep it real, I can do anything. And that will do it for us today on Press Play. Thank you for listening. Enjoy your week. Enjoy the rest of your day. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.